Welcome to We Talk Comics Special. I'm Brett. We got Mo over here.
Hello.
And our special guest today is Paul Aller. How are you doing, Paul?
Hey, guys. I am doing quite well. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, we are super happy to have you on. Writer of Strange Nation, as well as Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Turtles in Time, and
yes.
Utrom Empire. Utrom?
I think Utrom, but you know, I don't think anyone actually knows for sure.
Well, you think you would know. I mean, if somebody's going to know.
You would think so, yes. Yeah. Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird probably know, but other than them, yeah. I've heard that Kevin says Utrom, so that's good enough.
All right, sounds good to
that
me.
That works.
Yeah.
All right, well, ASA, really do appreciate your coming on. So we'll probably, if you don't mind, let's go through and give your kind of our listeners a bit of a background on you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So where do you live? Where did you grow up?
I live in Indiana right now. I was born in San Antonio, Texas, and kind of bounced around quite a bit through my late teens and early adulthood before ending up in Indiana. Yeah, and actually, I work for my local government here, and I started reading comics just about 7 years ago, so I'm fairly new to all of that as well.
In your late 20s, is that right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I believe I was 28. The first comic book I read was Astonishing X-Men, Joss Whedon's run.
Oh, so you did it okay then.
Now, yeah. I'm actually interested by that. I mean, if you don't read comics until you're in your late 20s, and then there's a certain stigma, obviously, I think for a lot of people related to what the books are or aren't. So what makes you go, you know what, let's give this a try, what the hell? Or what is it? What is kind of your attitude?
Yeah.
Are you going into it going, I'll try it, but I'm not expecting much? Or how does that kind of occur?
I don't think I ever really had that stigma. I never, honestly, didn't really think about comics one way or the other. And I mean, like, I had read comics as a kid because everyone does. You know, like, I'd read Archie, I'd read, you know, the stray Batman comic that happened to cross my path, that sort of thing. But never regularly. Like, I've never actually bought one, you know, that all that good stuff. But yeah, no, a coworker knew that I was a Joss Whedon fan, and so he bought me a copy of that first Astonishing X-Men trade in like a gift exchange thing that we had at work, and I really loved it. And I found out that the second trade was just about to come out, so I purchased it as well, and then I started buying the single issues of it, and then started buying single issues of other comics, and it very, very quickly snowballed from there.
And did a light bulb literally go off your head as you're reading that trade paperback?
Literally, yes.
Yeah.
It shot electricity through my brain. It was quite painful.
Yeah.
I really did start pretty much reading them and writing them at the same time. I mean, I've been a writer my entire life. I was working as a journalist at the time that I started reading comics. And it seemed like a medium that I thought I would be well suited for. So I kind of latched onto it very quickly.
So you must have really thrown yourself into the medium, because, I mean, it's one of those cases where it's definitely not a natural progression to instantly start writing comic book scripts.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And I mean, for a long time, I didn't really know what I was doing. I was pretty much just writing them on my own. I wrote like a couple thousand pages of comics before I even tried to get an artist to work with, just kind of trying to learn the craft and trying to learn what I was doing. And a big stepping stone along the way was taking a writing class through Comics Experience that really helped point me in the right direction in terms of what to actually do with all these scripts and how to move forward.
And that, and you actually met a lot of other creators that you've collaborated with there, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. How hard or easy has that been for you then to find all the artists that you're collaborating with?
It was pretty hard early on. I mean, for the first book I put out was a book called Clockwork, which is a collection of 12 5-page stories. So like before I even had put anything out, I had worked with over a dozen different artists. Because it's actually a second volume of Clockwork that's coming out in...
yeah, I was going to ask about that. You're answering your question already.
I believe your webpage says, look forward to Clockwork Volume 2 in 2012.
Yeah.
Does the webpage? I know the last page of the actual print book says that.
So well, maybe it's the print book.
Perhaps. Yeah, it could be.
You can change a webpage. You can't change a book that you've printed on.
Yeah, because I think also there was it was Orcurl when I was reading that from Challenger Comics that there's a few stories in the back of that of the digital edition, and so I noticed that they were from a couple of them were from Clockwork. Yeah.
As I say, obviously we've been checking out your work, and there is a couple stories that are Clockwork stories. Online on your website, people can read that aren't part of that first trade paperback. First trade paperback, I have to say, we're highly impressed. I mean, that's where we had this interview and opportunity for it, and started looking into your work a little more detailed. And that's the first thing I read and from you, and I was highly impressed. I mean, one of the things that really gets me is how much you are consciously playing with the medium as a writer, which I think, especially for somebody just getting into the industry, is kind of a rare thing.
Thanks. I appreciate that, and it's interesting because I actually kind of saw it as the opposite of the fact that I should be playing with the medium because I'm new to the industry. That I felt like because it was early on in my career, that's when I should be kind of experimenting and pushing myself and trying different genres and different styles and forms. Of course, I try to keep doing that. With each project that comes out, I try to give it a different tone, a different flavor, so that I'm not pigeonholed as X type of writer. So I don't know. And I know that Turtles in Time, which either is coming out or has come out. When is this airing?
It'll probably be airing this coming week.
Okay, so Turtles in Time, number one, which is out this week, is like by far the most broadly comedic thing that I've ever done, and that was a lot of fun. It really, let me use some tools that I don't get to very often, and I really enjoyed that out of it.
So let's see now. Before we get back into Turtles in Time, you created Clockwork kind of as a calling card, right? For getting discovered
pretty much
being able to get your work out.
Exactly. I kind of saw it as my equivalent of like an artist portfolio, and it's good because it's long enough. I felt like because it was 60 pages of stories, it showed editors that I was able to put together a larger project and that I wasn't just writing one short thing. But at the same time, because each of those 12 stories is only 5 pages long, you could pick it up, read one story, and you've just spent a couple minutes of your time, and it's giving you at least some idea of whether I know what I'm doing or not. So
how does it work? Are you looking at that? I mean, in that situation, you're putting out a book. It's largely to get recognition. You can't really go into it with expectations of sales. So how does it work with the artist and the collaboration and any sort of pay scale? Like, I don't need obviously details, but is it just kind of the same thing for them? It's more about visibility?
No. I paid a page rate to all the artists on it. I went pretty deep into debt doing Clockwork, the first of many times. I don't say that begrudgingly towards the artists at all. No, I mean I was very happy to have been able to get so many amazing people on board. They deserve to be paid for the awesome work that they did. But no, on Clockwork and a lot of subsequent projects, I've tried to maintain a page rate. I should say that's not to say that I don't that I have anything against working on the back end, but I feel like I feel like if you're working for back end, there should be a reasonable expectation about whether there's going to be any back end. And I know that other people do projects for back end that they know aren't going to make any money, and that's cool. If everyone is an adult and knows what they're doing going in, that's fine. But for me personally, I don't want to do a back end project that I know isn't going to have any back end. So I wasn't comfortable doing that until I got to the point in my career where I might actually be able to put out something at a larger publisher where there was a realistic expectation that the artist would essentially earn their money in the end.
Now, is there any stories within this book that you kind of would like to bring back in another form within Clockwork that you think that, you know, it's more than a 5-page story? You want to expand upon it?
It's interesting. I actually, like, one of the rules, I guess, for lack of a better word, that I set for myself was I wanted to make them all very much self-contained stories. Because honestly, I feel like the majority of short comics out there really are just like thinly veiled pitches. You know what I mean? And I didn't want to do that. So of the stories in there, I think probably like most of them don't really even lend themselves to doing more. And of those that do, I'll say there's one that I've discussed with the artist, bringing back at some point, and he's expressed some interest in that, but I'd rather not say which one, because then I'm kind of putting him on the spot publicly.
Well, I just like to I just like to bring up my favorite, maybe Bro pick up, bring up his favorite from the series, because I did enjoy them quite a bit. Maybe just give me a comment on it. My favorite one was The Day I Go Home. So please explain everybody that one.
The Day I Go Home was actually the first one that I wrote.
Oh, really?
I wrote that one in the Comics Experience writing class. Because that class, like before that, I'd been, like I said, I'd written a lot of stuff before then, but I'd mostly been focusing on writing like 22-page one-shots and miniseries and like bits of ongoings. So, you know, I have on my hard drive just a whole bunch of really terrible full-length comics that no one will ever see. And then in the Comics Experience, they in the beginning writing class, you write a 5-page comic script, because Andy Schmidt, the former IDW and Marvel editor who started Comics Experience and teaches the writing classes, his philosophy is, or not philosophy, but what he says is basically that writing a 5-page story, a good complete 5-page story with an arc and strong characters, is much harder than writing a 22-page story, even though that seems a little bit counterintuitive. And so if you can do that, then you're well equipped to do a larger one. And after working on The Day I Go Home in that class, I kind of really saw his point. And so that was kind of what set me off on. I didn't immediately think I'm going to do a whole book of 5-page stories then. But what I thought coming out of that class was I want to focus on writing 5-page stories for a while, because that does seem like a really great challenge and it teaches you so much about your craft. And as a result of that, I started writing a whole bunch of these. And at a certain point, I started looking at them going, you know, I really actually kind of don't hate a lot of these. So maybe I've never put out an actual comic before. I've been thinking lately that that's something that would be a logical next step. So maybe it would be good to collect some of these. But anyway, yeah. So The Day I Go Home, I wrote it in the class, and this is one of the more experimental ones. Basically, it's a story where I'm playing with continuity and time in a way that you hopefully don't realize right away that I'm doing so. So it's structured in such a way that, and I'm going to give it away here, but who cares? It's been a couple years. It's structured in such a way that if you're just reading it through, it should read like a continuous story. And yet at the same time, if you go back and pay attention, every single panel could be at a different point in time. Like none of the panels actually necessarily have to come one after the other. It's this guy taking the same action over and over and over again over the course of months and years and decades. And so it's structured in a way that it reads as a continuous action story, but it's actually every single panel is a different point in time as he makes another attempt at trying to escape from this planet. And because of that, you see him getting older as you go through the panels and pages. And my hope is that, like, you don't necessarily get what's happening, but that at a certain point you start realizing he's getting older and think, well, that's odd. And I've had some people have said they thought it was because he was being exposed to radiation in some of the panels and different things like that. So no, that was a really fun story to write, and a real structural challenge to kind of experiment with the form and try to make that work.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I completely got what you're doing with it like that. And the fact that it was within five pages, it contained so much story, such an interesting concept, flowed, and it's paced so well, which is one of the things that I appreciate about your work. I find it paced extremely well.
Well, thank you.
Again, you made, to me, within five pages, you managed to make an emotional impact to me as a reader. Very difficult to do. And so that's what I really thought was really stood out for me about it. I'll let Brett talk about his favorite.
Well, it's interesting because the one that I kind of come to is has got something similar. It's X Row.
Oh yeah, yeah. X Row is a story about a death row inmate. And again, yeah, it is another one that experiments with time and with what you can do with a comics medium. But in the case of X Row, it skips around in time because you're basically seeing a guy's memories as he's about to be executed. And I really wanted to sort of show, we kind of show a big swath of his life, but in a very disjointed way. And in a way where intentionally it's not like all the puzzle pieces don't like add up to some big revelation at the end. You know, it's not like, you know, I saw all this stuff happen out of order and now I understand. It's just kind of showing his life, and hopefully you gain a little bit more insight into this character by the end. But like I said, it's intentionally not plotted in such a way that it's like some big shocking thing that we've built up.
How difficult is that to write when you're jumping around panel to panel, time period? How much of his whole life do you have to have in your head that you aren't sharing?
You know, I don't really know how much in that particular case. That was actually based on – that one's a little unusual because that was actually very loosely based on a real person. Back when I was a journalist, I covered the story of a gentleman who from the town that I live in who was executed. And he was the only death row inmate who's ever come out of this town. And so a lot of the biographical details come from him, because I interviewed his friends and family and I went to his parole hearing, where as part of his parole hearing, they basically took him through his entire life story before denying him clemency. But yeah, so in that particular case, like I had a much better idea than I usually do because of that, because it was based on a real person. But oftentimes, like when I get that question, the answer is honestly that I don't give a lot of thought to what happens off panel. Like, and I know a lot of writers tend to do like the whole world building thing and like an autobiographical sketch of the character, and they'll have all of that they're leaving off the page. I tend to pretty much what's on the page is what I worked with and what I know.
So, well, let's talk about Orc Girl then. How did that come around?
Yeah, after I did Clockwork Volume 1. We talked about the Volume 2 thing very briefly, but just
to
explain that. Basically, like Clockwork was originally going to be 24 five-page stories rather than 12. And I actually got like 18 of them done, and I was having some trouble putting the final six together. And I got some good advice from a friend of mine who was like, you know, it could take you a lot longer to finish this, and you've been working on it for quite a while. You should really just put out the first 12 as like a first volume and go from there. And I was like, yeah, that's great. So I did, with every intention of putting out the second volume the following year. But really, it just became sort of a money issue where, you know, the first one, I'm glad I put it out, but it was very expensive and it really set me back. And after I put it out, like a lot of people, and by people, I mean editors and, you know, other folks, were like, hey, this is really awesome. I'd love to see a 22-page story from you. See what you can do with that. And so it didn't make sense to spend a huge amount of money again to put out the second volume right away. So that's why it's been kind of lying in wait for all these years. Well, so
let's just where can people find both volumes? Where can they get them? And What's the price?
And, obviously, they're not going to find Volume 2 yet. But
I'm sure you have a plan.
Yeah.
Right. The first volume, if you go to clockworkcomic.com, the whole thing is online for free. Because that's
how. But when they want to pay you, because they do.
Yeah. If you scroll down on that, there's a link. I think it says like visit the clock shop or something. It's been like 4 or 5 years since I set up the site. Where you can purchase the physical print edition of it. So and volume 2 will be out eventually. I think I may kickstart it at some point, but man, Kickstarter looks really intimidating.
Yeah. Well, you know what? If you want to talk about Kickstarter, I mean, and we want to get into Orc Girl, but obviously you have a relationship with the guys at Comics Tribe, and they've had great success. So that's
they know more about that stuff than a lot of folks. That's for sure.
That's true. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, Kickstarter is such a great tool. It makes sense that I'm going to use it at some point, maybe for Clockwork Volume 2. I've talked to an artist about a graphic novella horror story that we're both really interested in doing. And I think maybe Kickstarter might be a good opportunity for that. I've also talked a lot online about a romance comic that I'm working on with Irene Coe. And we're kind of talking to publishers about that right now. But I know that romance is a tough pitch to publishers. So that's one that if we don't get it picked up anywhere, then that will definitely be
interesting point that you say
Kickstarter bound.
Interesting point you said that's a tough pitch to publishers, because romantic comedies are huge in the field of movies. So why is it that there's a lack of them in the field of comics? Is it just the fan base is still too much a male demographic?
I think it's more a perception than a reality. I think there's a really good I think there's a really healthy audience for a romance comic. It's just a matter of reaching that audience and doing the necessary, you know, work and marketing and all of that other great stuff, for lack of a better term. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's partly inertia, partly just the fact that it is a new and untested market, and that is intimidating, you know, because comics are expensive to make, and publishers, I think, in this market do have to be, unfortunately, somewhat conservative in order to make it.
True, but I see books like Saga and Kill Shakespeare, which have such a huge female demographic reading them, and I know that I think that's a growing area, and you know, and it doesn't have to necessarily just be females who can be interested in a romance comic. Anybody who's interested in a good story can certainly. I mean, obviously, again, the movies are marketed towards a female demographic, but you know, it doesn't necessarily have to just be that.
I agree.
Excellent. Let's move on to the very nice Orc Girl. Great work there, Brett.
Yeah, Orc Girl. I certainly read it and loved it. So how did that come about? And then also I wanted to ask how it came about that you got Gail Simone's quote on the back of it.
Sure. Let me start with that part. I actually purchased a script critique from her through some Kickstarter. I can't remember which one. So yeah, she read a script of mine and gave me a very nice critique of it. And in the course of that, she was like, by the way, if you ever, you know, she liked my writing and basically said, if you ever need anything, let me know. And then when I had Orc Girl and I thought that I'd like to have a nice back cover quote on it, I remember her saying that and thought that it was a good match of content and blurber. And so that was pretty much how that came about. And your other question was just how Orc Girl in general came about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. So after I did Clockwork, a lot of people were like, "Hey, this is great. Now I'd like to see something from you that's 22 pages." And I was like, "Oh, I need to do another comic now." Shit. So I started thinking and kind of cast around with a lot of different ideas. And I'm not sure even how this story idea necessarily came to me. I think the seed of it was wanting to do like a coming of age story with a fantasy creature, but you know, not have it be like, not have it have the traditional trappings of a fantasy story at all. you know, just this isn't like the fantasy creature that goes out and has a grand epic adventure. This is the fantasy creature that, you know, grows up and learns valuable lessons about life and all that good stuff. And through that seed, I kind of kicked it around in my head a lot and thought about it. And this story just sort of slowly developed through that. And it is interesting how many people, like, when they hear the title Orc Girl, and, you know, they think it's going to be some big, you know, sword and sandals type fantasy epic, and it's really very kind of a quiet chamber music-y piece. So yeah, and I don't know, I'm really very proud of that book. And one of the things I like about it is that I feel like a lot of people, when they put out these like single issue books early on in their careers, do something that's really like, you know, extreme, and this is going to get your attention, and, you know, this has all these wacky elements in it that are, and I kind of went in the opposite direction of just doing like a really quiet story that was as solid as I could possibly make it.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that I really liked about the fact was that it was a little more quiet and more, well, I guess down to earth even.
Yeah. Yeah.
But one thing that I'll ask is, now I was able to buy the digital edition and the print edition as well. Well, also from available from Challenger Comics. Now, Challenger is our friend Ryan Ferrier here. Yep. How did you get involved with Ryan and get onto Challenger?
How the heck did I meet Ryan? I can't even remember now.
Calgary guy.
Was it Monkey Brain?
No, we've known each other long before that. Mm-hmm. I can't remember right now how I met Ryan.
We'll just ask him.
But
yeah.
But I met him, yes. and I knew that he was planning on kind of using his Challenger Comics imprint. He had this model in mind of sort of using it as a self-publishing platform for people to use. And I really liked that idea. I thought this book was a good fit for that. And so, thankfully I think I was the first book that Challenger Comics put out that wasn't written by Ryan. And I was really thrilled to have that opportunity. And, it was a lot of fun.
No, it's great. And it's nice to that people can get your stuff there. I mean, I like the fact that a lot of your stuff is available digitally as well as in print. And I think that, you know, you now working with Monkey Brain on the Strange Nation, I mean, what's it like then to prepare it digitally as well as for print, or just digitally?
There's not a lot of difference. I mean, the difference would be, you know, a lot of boring stuff about saving it in RGB instead of CMYK and, you know, the type of file that you send over. But other than that, no, the Monkey Brain prep is pretty much very similar to the print prep, except just different factors involved. Woo, that was exciting.
Yeah, no, that's all right. We're going to get a little bit more into the works of A Strange Nation for sure, because I loved it. But I just want to know, because cool. You did bring up Comics Tribe. How did you get to know Tyler James and Joe Mulvey and the fine folks over there? We've had a relationship with them since, I think, their first issues were, we were like the first podcast had them on.
Yeah.
So, and we've had a really strong relationship ever since. And I see this as a company that just really talented people slowly building their way up and making strides. And it's really exciting to see.
Yeah. Again, I'm not sure exactly how I met them, but I think I met them through some mutual friends. And I met them in person at the NYCC a couple years ago. And yeah, they've been nice enough to ask me to do a couple stories in their various anthologies. So it's been a lot of fun.
Okay. Nothing you want to share about Joe Mulvey? I mean, he's always telling us about the strip joints.
Yeah,
hit one with him? Come on, tell the truth.
I was totally going
to. I have not.
No? Because no, you know that'd sadly. Be fun.
Yeah,
uh-huh. I think that Joe actually lives in a monastery, and he lives a very quiet monastic life, but he has this character that he has to put forth to the world in order to help sell his books.
Bullshit. Uh-huh.
Oh, apparently we've never met Joe Mulvey.
Yeah, yeah. Talking to somebody else the whole time.
Right.
So then. Monkey Brain, like, I know that that, you know, not too many people actually get picked to work for Monkey Brain. So what was that like?
Yeah, I was very happy to have that happen. Kind of a symptom Strange Nation, thinking that it probably would not get picked up, and they were kind enough to like it and give it a shot. And it's been, I mean, they have so many absolutely amazing books. Their business model is great, and Chris and Allison are just wonderful people and so incredibly supportive of the creators that they work with as well. So yeah, that's been a really great experience.
Is there more coming out?
A Strange Nation?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's the first arc is 8 issues.
Okay.
Five issues are available now, I believe.
5 issues are available now. The 6th one is coming out next month. And then should have a couple more, like, every 5 to 6 weeks or so after that.
Wonderful.
We're hoping to do more.
Give everybody the elevator pitch of what Strange Nation is, without giving away too much.
Sure. Strange Nation is a story about a woman named Norma Park, who is a very well-respected, legitimate journalist who has a bright future. And then she stumbles across this just bizarre story involving UFOs and doomsday cults and Bigfoot, basically just like every tabloid story you've ever seen, all connected together in this one weird conspiracy plot. And she, because being a good journalist, she tries to publish the story, and she's fired and laughed out of journalism for wanting to publish it and for sticking to it and not backing down from it. And eventually the only job she can get is at a tabloid called Strange Nation, which is like a weekly world news type of a paper, where she continues to investigate this story. And it's the story of her investigation, of her trying to get the truth out, and of everything that comes from that.
Now, does that come from your journalistic background? Did you wind up dealing with a few of those things?
Bigfoot?
Yeah.
Bigfoot or big giant conspiracies?
It definitely comes from my own journalism experience. The bits about the UFOs may have been slightly elaborated. But yeah, the story was definitely my attempt to write about journalism and my thoughts on the profession of journalism, on folks who do work to expose the truth of what's going on in this world, despite a tremendous personal cost to themselves and an unexpected cost to the people around them.
The artist on this, Juan Romero.
Yes, Juan is so fantastic.
Yeah, he's tremendous. And there's a local artist named Scott Kowalczyk here, who worked for Oni and now is doing some work with DC, who has a style very similar to that. I've been a big fan of Scott. So as soon as I saw this, I thought, this is like Scott, but, you know, a similarity. And I love it. And so it really hit me, even perhaps in a different way than other people. I was really, really studying his art, and he's great. How did he get to work with you on this book?
He did one of the stories in Clockwork. I think I met Juan when I had put out an ad looking for artists for Clockwork, and he was one of the folks who responded. So I was just lucky enough to meet him that way. And we did a story together in Clockwork called Reach the Sun. And then I knew I wanted to work with him again. And when I was putting together Strange Nation, I thought of him, and I thought that he would be really fantastic for it. And I think I was right, because Juan has really great ability to – he's really good at small character moments, at really capturing, you know, what's going on in the inner lives of the characters. And he's also really good at the wacky sci-fi elements of it. So that's tough to find in one artist. And so because of that, he really just kills it on this book, every single issue.
And Aaron Houston is another artist that you've worked with multiple times.
Oh yeah.
Tell us about him.
Oh man, Aaron is so fantastic. Yeah, Aaron, I worked with on X-Row, and I've done a couple of the Comics Tribe anthology stories with him, and we have some other stuff cooking up as well, long gestating projects, you could call them. But yeah, Aaron is just his sense of composition is so good. And he infuses so much fun into all of his work. I mean, he's just such a fantastic illustrator with a very unique style. I'd work with that guy on something for the rest of my life if I could. He's really fantastic. I've been very, very lucky to have worked with a lot of just absolutely amazing folks pretty early on in my career.
You know, one of the things that, like you're saying, would really impress us about Clockwork is just the quality of the artists that were in there. Another thing that was impressive in that and all your works, especially for a young writer, or at least young to the industry, is your...
That's not saying you're old.
Yeah, well...
He's old.
I'm old, yeah. And look at me. I'm so old.
Yeah.
But one of the things is that you give a lot of space for the artist to tell the story without using words. I mean, there's large sections where and where, you know, it's, I mean, it's a visual medium, and you really seem to have an understanding of that. And also the way you break down the artist's strengths and weaknesses as a writer, the fact that you do that for us in Clockwork and give us those moments where you tell them what they're contributing, to me is very impressive. I mean, Greg Ruck is a guy we talked to recently, and he said he only recently started trying to write to an artist's strengths, and it seems to be something you're doing very early in your career, and I think that's a great thing.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's definitely something that I at least try to do. Yes.
Is the comics experience, do they help you with that too? Is that one of the things that they teach there, or?
Yeah. Andy definitely talks about that quite a bit. But yeah, I think a part of it is just keeping open communication about, you know, the stuff people always say about, you know, what kind of stuff do you like to write and blah, 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 blah. Although, honestly, I'm less about that and more about just kind of trying to see what I think would work well with their style. I mean, I shouldn't say I'm less about that, 'cause obviously if the artist says I don't want to write, you know, I don't want to draw horses, I'm not going to, you know, have a story open on a splash page of a field of horses. Shit, I should do that. That would be awesome.
That's
main characters double, of horses?
Double page spread, yes. Horses riding horses. with horses flying overhead.
You should just write My Little Pony. You thought of that?
Yes. but yeah, I try to figure out what makes their style so great, what it is that they bring to the table, and sort of play into that. And in a way that sometimes will, like, you know, will be something that they haven't done before, but that I think that they'll be really excellent at based on that. So, which isn't, I don't know, it sounds like I'm saying, you know, I have this extraordinary ability to know what they're going to be good at, which that all sounds arrogant, but anyway, everyone knows what I mean. I'm going to shut up now.
Just stick with that. It's good.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So now you've also done work for IDW on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles series. Now, how did it come around that you got that job? Because, I mean, that's a fairly big gig overall.
Yeah, that was based on me sending Clockwork out to a bunch of editors. One of them I sent it to was Bobby Kernow over at IDW, and he oversees the Turtles stuff, and he gave me the opportunity to pitch on a couple different things before he picked up one of my Turtles pitches and liked the work I did, and it kind of went from there. So yeah, I've been very fortunate to do a lot of really cool work on the IDW Turtles books.
Have you got more? Like, I know we've got Turtles in Time coming up, so I'll certainly get you to talk about that. Is there anything else that you've got coming up with them afterwards, or are you just kind of waiting to the next pitch session?
That's probably my last Turtles work for at least quite a while. I don't know how long, but yeah. In terms of the main IDW continuity, you know, they have that book pretty tightly locked down well in advance of what they want to do, and they have a lot of projects going on with it. So I'm always happy to pitch whenever they have that opportunity available. But yeah, Turtles in Time is probably going to be it for a while.
Turtles in Time is some way related to the legendary side-scrolling beat 'em up?
No.
Okay. No. I don't know if you ever played that game. It's one of the most iconic side-scrolling video games in the.
No, I've since learned that. I actually I'm not much of a video game person, so I had never played that particular game. But based on every fan of that game asking me that question in the month since the project was announced, I've since learned that it's apparently kind of a big deal.
I'll edit that out then.
Yes. No, it's fine.
You're,
it's cool.
You're going to get a lot of extra sales because of that.
It's a legitimate question. It's a question people are interested in. And like I said, I think there's a lot of interest in the book based on that video game. So that was very, very smart of Bobby to name it that and come up with that. But no, outside of the idea of the turtles bouncing around in time and having adventures in different time periods, that's pretty much the extent of it. I do know that, like, the way Turtles in Time is structured, it's a 4-issue mini, and I'm writing issues 1 and 4, and Eric Burnham is writing issues 2 and 3. Issue 2 is a little bit more inspired by the game. So, you know, if you're into that sort of thing, feel free to just skip my issue and pick up issue 2 next month.
Now, were you a Turtles fan kind of growing up with the cartoon or the movies?
No. Time. I was a huge, huge Turtles fan. Yeah, I was like one of the big iconic things of my childhood. So to get the opportunity to work on it is pretty amazing. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah. You ever get a chance to meet or talk to Laird or Eastman or anything like that?
No. Bobby has like passed along emails where Kevin Eastman has been like, "Hey, I really like that issue these guys did," and you know, I'm like, "Oh my god, oh my god, oh my god!" but yeah, no, I've had some secondhand correspondence with him, but yeah, I've never had the opportunity to meet him personally.
We'll send you our picture we took with him and we interviewed him.
He's a very nice guy. Super nice guy. His
name drop.
Isn't that
you're not
nice?
Not that big a shot. Yeah, we've been with. Anyways.
Yeah. Let's list out who we've talked to.
Yeah.
It's our show.
No, it's right? Okay. I fully expect you to reach the upper echelon of most popular writers in the industry, because I think the quality of work is that high. So in a few years, we'll be telling people we talked to Paul and Laura, they'll be like, "Bullshit, you don't know him."
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll be talking about your Marvel or DC work, and it'll be...
What is a character out there that you're like, man, I'd love to get my hands on that guy?
Oh, gosh. There are a lot of them. I don't like to answer that question because I feel like... It's being presumptuous, you know what I mean?
Just you and me.
Because exactly. But no, publishers have plans for these characters, and they really, you know, they know what they're doing, and they're trying to do what's best for them. So I always feel like it's presumptuous to be like, you know who should be writing XYZ character? Me! That's who! So no, I don't know. I do hope, like, I haven't had any opportunities yet to pitch on the big two. And of course it's dumb for a comics writer to say, "Hey, I'd like the opportunity to work on them big name superheroes." Cause yeah, no shit you would. You and everyone else out there. But no, I am hoping that at some time in the next several years, I'll work up to the point where I have an opportunity to do that. I've just been thinking more and more lately about what I would try to do with various, you know, big two characters, and that's an opportunity I really relish on a lot of them. So we shall see.
Let's talk a little bit about what happens
far down the road.
How about the idea of moving into working for the big two and then getting a chance to write from a different perspective? Because I mean, one of the things that we've seen you do is edit some books. So how do you start to edit different books, and what's that experience like?
Yeah, that pretty much came out of just, like, I have friends, they write books, I write books too. Hey, you want me to edit your book? Sure, I can do that. That's just pretty much as simple as that. So, a lot of my editing work has just sprung out of relationships that I have with the writers and with the creators involved. And it gives me an opportunity to kind of flex a different set of muscles and work to,
Yeah. Work to, yeah.
That answer kind of trailed off.
Oh, that's all right. That's one of the books that you. What's that?
I should probably explain to your listeners, for anyone who's dumb enough to have not been able to figure it out yet, that I'm a little bit under the weather tonight. So yeah, normally I am just coherent as shit, and I speak in full complete paragraphs that would make you weep at their structural comprehensity.
It's okay. Our listeners are used to listening to us, so they don't have high expectations.
Okay. That's right. That's
excellent.
You're still doing them better than he does. Really.
Yeah.
Excellent.
One of the books you edited, I picked up just 99 cents an issue. I think it was Infinity Comics is who published it. And it's called Deluge.
Deluge.
Deluge. Deluge. Deluge.
Deluge.
Deluge. It's called Deluge, as I said. And I thought this was just a wonderful book. It blew me away. So,
yeah.
You know, what's your kind of role in helping to shape that? Because not only is the art by Richard P. Clarke great, but the writer, J.D. Oliva? I'm hoping they really brave choices with the characters and the story that rarely do you see in a book like that. And that, I think that's what stood out.
Right. Yeah, JD really did a fantastic job with that. And again, that was a case of it just coming from a situation where, you know, JD is a friend of mine. He's a good enough friend that I couldn't tell you exactly how to pronounce his last name. Sorry. And
I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Internet friends. But yeah, I he asked me if I would be willing to come on and help him out with that book, and I was really happy to. And honestly, like in a situation like that, it kind of my work is pretty minimal because the guys I'm working with are so talented. But I pretty much just tried to help him achieve what he wanted to achieve with that book, in terms of, you know, reading over scripts and talking him through any points that he wanted to discuss and all that good stuff.
Did he have any questions about to you? And is that the right move with this character? Is that too bold? Is that too, you know? And were you ever talking to somebody that go for it? Just go for it, because the book goes for it. And I'm going to be writing a blog further about this book because I think it's so wonderful and I'd love people to read it, especially for, you know, $3 for three issues.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, were there any points where you're just like, yeah, you got to go for it here?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, I don't want to overemphasize my role at all because, like, JD pretty much had it going on from the beginning. But yeah, I think there were definitely points where he had the first issue more or less in the can script wise when I came on, and it was really good, and he'd gotten a really positive response from other people about that, and so I think that kind of put a lot of pressure on him for the rest of the scripts. So like a part of the conversation we had early on was pretty much me just saying, hey, you know, you've got this. It's cool. You know, just write the story you're going to write and try to put out of your mind, you know, the idea that is this as good as the first issue was. So
again, yeah. It's, I know it's difficult there's a lot of good books out there. There's a lot of talent. Difficult when you're, you know, I mean, self-publishing like that to get people necessarily to pick it up and give it a shot. And when it's that high quality, I really hope people do, and so I'll say it on the podcast and talk a little more about it. Another book that same thing, Gutter Magic. What again? Is there only one issue of that out?
I think he has a second issue out.
He has a second issue, and I don't know, you know, kind of how much again your role is with that. I just got one issue because I saw your name on it as an editor. I was curious,
right?
And Brett Barkley creates a really interesting world, but Rich Doak, and again, I hope I'm saying it right. I thought his art's just terrific.
Yeah, that one I do know. It's a Rich Duick, I believe.
Duick. Okay.
Yeah, and yeah. Again, when you're working with really talented people, you just kind of have to step back and, you know, try not to get in the way and do what you can to help them out along the way.
Do they? You say these are friends of yours. So are these friends of yours you knew prior to comics, or are these friends that you have developed through the comics industry, through conventions, through publishers, or?
Friends I've developed through the comics industry.
Do you go to a lot of conventions?
Not really. Living in Indiana, I don't go to as many as I would like to.
Is there a big convention in Indiana?
No.
No.
No. Chicago's pretty close by. Yeah. They have a couple.
One or two, maybe.
Well, maybe what we got to do is we got to get you up here to Calgary next year, and we'll take you up there, and you know, hopefully you'll be feeling better. We'll take you out for some authentic Canadian food and beer.
That would be fantastic.
All right, we'll hook it up for you.
That's right.
Excellent. Brett, go ahead.
Well, now you mentioned on Twitter a little while ago that that you had about 5 creator-owned projects coming up. Now you've certainly touched on some of them. How close are you to getting some of those out?
Yeah, I wish I hadn't said that.
Oh, okay.
Because you know, I mean, shit falls through, and you know, already like a couple of those are kind of looking pretty iffy. So I don't know. We'll see. But my book, Past the Last Mountain with Third World, it premiered on a Free Comic Book Day, so that should be coming out later on in this year, and I'm very excited about that one. The rest of them haven't been announced yet, but yeah, that one I can kind of speak to.
Okay, well, tell us a little more about it then.
Yeah, speak on.
Sure. It's a geopolitical fantasy. Is kind of the phrase I'm using for it is a geopolitical fantasy, which I'm going to keep on saying until the publisher asks me not to. And it's about it's basically about a 3 fantasy creatures, a troll, a dragon, and a fawn who are on the run from the American military.
One of the things that I've noticed that when you're telling your storylines, you often use a captions of first person narrative to tell the characters the character's point of view, and this is obviously one of your favorite techniques. You were using it a little bit less as Strange Nation is going on, I've noticed, but it's been something you've done, you did in a lot of your other works, and so what's the strength of that kind of style of writing? What do you think you're so drawn to?
Yeah, Strange Nation number 6 has not a single first-person caption in it. I think 5 had like 1 or 2, mm-hmm. So 6 would be the first one that doesn't have a single one. And I was kind of like, do I want to try to shoehorn one in just for consistency's sake? Then I was like, nah, screw it. But then, yeah, 7 and 8 are already written, and it goes back to them a little bit there. It's funny you should say that, because I'm actually trying to get away from that a little bit with some of my projects. I think it has its uses, and there's a lot of interesting things you can do with first-person narration. I think it can very easily be overused, and I think it can very easily be poorly used. And I think it's unfortunately kind of getting a little bit of reputation amongst at least some readers based on the fact that it is often rather poorly used and used in a way where it's basically just a way to, you know, sort of, I am the main character. You think you know me, but you don't. Here's exactly what I'm thinking at every second. And so, yeah, when I do use it, I try to use it with a deliberate intent. It can be a very interesting tool to sort of contrast a character's inner thoughts with what is going on in the rest of the story, or to add some sense of depth or perspective to it, rather than it just being like this hammer that you're using to like, here is what I'm thinking every second, and I don't have time for exposition, so I'm doing this instead. So I actually have been trying to get away from it more recently. And in my upcoming projects, most of them do not use it. There's one that does, and that's because it's a story that's structured in such a way that a lot happens in a very small space. And so I'm kind of, again, my intent with the first person narration in that story is to use it in a way that that sort of allows us to glide over certain moments in hopefully a somewhat elegant way. That all sounds kind of silly.
It's okay. I understand. And you know what? I certainly wasn't trying to be critical. I just noticed it was something that was common,
right.
and that you have been moving away from. And I do think it's a very, I mean, we don't use word balloons anymore. So, I mean, it's a modern way of storytelling that's become very popular. And there are advantages to it. There can be good things about it. But anyways, yeah. We're both fighting to get to the next question here, so I'll let Brett go. Oh, sure.
Well, I think I just wanted to make a comment because it is such an of the time kind of thing with that narration. I mean, we actually wound up reading a Tomb Raider comic for the podcast a while ago, and it was funny because it was
from 2001.
From 2001, yeah. And it was built almost completely with these narration blocks, and it was just so dense and heavy, and it just as I'm reading it just seemed ridiculous, because as I read new comics, I'm not used to reading a comic book like that anymore.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
It was just clunky, you know, and then now it seems so much more streamlined.
And like, I've talked to people on my LCS who are like, you know, I like a book that takes me a long time to read, and you know, I don't think the number of words in a comic is necessarily an intrinsically good thing about the comic, and a lot of people do seem to still have that attitude.
Yeah, it's very interesting because there are people who absolutely put a lot of words in that I think are still very good, because they do a ton of research, and it shows that you know, they're really they're trying their best to put a lot into the comic book. But then there's also, like, just using words for the sake of words, and, I mean...
Well, some of the times, it almost seems that when you have oddly enough, you have an artist come on and write their first few skips tend to be overwritten, and they're artists, so you think that they would understand the visual side, but it's almost, I don't know if it's an insecurity or inexperience, but sometimes they're the ones who are actually overwriting the scripts more than anybody else.
Well, yeah, writing is tough, and it does seem to be sort of a weird attitude amongst not everyone, but amongst a lot of people in comics, that, you know, writing is the easy part. So, you know, if you're an artist, you should just go ahead and write your own stuff, and you can just go out and do it. And so I think you do tend to see a lot of stuff with some very basic craft issues in them. There are a lot of amazing writer artists out there. And there are also a lot of comics writers who, you know, have some very basic craft issues with their stuff as well. So as I'm saying this, I'm kind of in my brain realizing that I'm full of shit.
Well, again, I'm not saying that there isn't talented ones. And again, most of them, I think, get better as they do it. It's just early on, it almost seems to be, it's almost the opposite. Like, I've been waiting so long to finally be able to say what I'm going to say. I'm going to say everything in this panel. And,
exactly.
You know, and so it's a strange thing, but maybe it's just me, because everybody knows I'm full of shit too. If you've met me,
that's true.
Say that.
Yep.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah. There you go. What about talking about some of those guys? Going back and kind of in history, if you don't start reading till you're in your late 20s, how much do you go back and read books from the 70s, the 80s, the 90s? How much does Is it studying the medium from those times and the different storytelling techniques, and how much of that do you kind of experience?
I do my best. I mean, I'm still obviously catching up. Things like the Marvel Comics Unlimited app and different things like that really are a huge help with that. But no, I mean, I read a lot of comics, and I do try to kind of find a balance of reading newer stuff that's coming out and going back and reading a lot of the awesome older stuff as well. So, but yeah, I kind of see that as being like an ongoing process. I don't think they'll get to the point where I'm like, okay, I've read all the old comics I need to read. Awesome.
I'm done
with that.
Well, how about some of those old books that you read? You went, wow, okay, they got it. I mean, this is many years ago, but they fully understand the medium, and it can be, you know, I can learn something from this I can apply today. What are some of those books?
I would never think like, hey, these guys really understood the medium despite being really old. And I know that I know that's not what you meant at all.
I know.
But
I know.
Just, you know, I would never have that sort of sense of, you know.
That is what I meant.
Some of them didn't understand it.
Here I am, 2014 man, looking back on these dark days before the comics were as good as they are now.
Actually, maybe it's the opposite. Maybe it's that we've regressed and there's so much to learn from those guys.
Mm-hmm. I can tell you one thing that I've been reading recently, because I am doing that romance comic that I mentioned earlier. So I'm reading the young romance books that Simon and Kirby did, and those are just so freaking amazing, just really fantastic, fantastic melodrama, and just so richly drawn in terms of the character work, and it's really just fantastic stuff. So yeah, Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, I hadn't heard of them before, but they seem to really know what they're doing. those two guys.
Yeah, possible, they got potential. Yeah. They got potential.
Somebody may have heard of one of them or two of them.
What about current books? Do you tend to go towards the smaller publishers? Do you kind of read from the big two? What do you look at in your personal reading? Not so much the specific books, but what kind of things are you trying to do, or specific books if you care to?
I whenever people ask for specific books, that's the exact moment when my brain empties out of any books that I'm reading. I generally do tend to skip around a lot in terms of, I do read, you know, a little bit of a fair amount of big two stuff. I read a lot of Image and creator owned stuff from smaller publishers, and I read a lot of really great licensed work as well. I think maybe, you know, because most of my work for hire stuff has been based on some of that like mid-level licensed work, I really try to keep an eye out for really good examples of that and check them out.
Now, Brett, did you have something you wanted to ask?
Nope.
I'm going to throw one out at you here. A few things we generally tend to ask. Here's a new one,
okay.
At least for me. What's a licensed property? Like, I don't know if you're a big movie guy, big TV guy. What's a licensed property that nobody has the rights to, that nobody knows, that you know of, that you think, damn, I could wish I could make that into a great comic book? Because then you're not ruining somebody's plans, because it's not something they were about to do.
That you know of.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, oh my, geez, I think of like so many of these on a weekly basis, but now my brain is just... just completely emptying out of any thought on that. So, man, I don't know. One I thought of recently was the Back to the Future franchise. I would really love to do some comics on that.
That have never been told. There's got to be tons.
Yeah, I tend to think though that like with a property that big and that obvious, anytime someone's like, "Why isn't anyone doing a blankety blank comic," someone has tried to get the license to that and has not been successful. You know what I mean? Like, oh, you know what? Well, okay, here's one that I thought of recently that I mentioned on Twitter. I would love to write a Little Shop of Horrors comic.
Oh, nice.
That would be so awesome. I would love to do it in a way where like the first arc or the first couple arcs are basically the original story that we're all familiar with, and then I keep going, you know, because no one's ever gone on to tell the story of, you know, the plants, you know, continuing to take over our planet. And I think it'll be really cool to, you know, to tell that initial story and then bring in new characters and new concepts and just keep on going with it. That's one I would really love
to
do.
That'd be a lot of fun. See?
Absolutely. There you go.
Yeah, right. There you go.
New idea.
And of course, the world needs a The Wire season 6 comic.
Yes.
I mean, I think if anything is ideally suited to the comics medium, it's The Wire. No, I'm the biggest The Wire fan, and that was like the worst thing I could think of to say. That would be an absolute horror show.
Oh, but honestly, I mean, if The Wire came, I would of course be there. You know,
like, I would too. I would be like, oh my god, how can you make a freaking comic out of The Wire? That's such a horrible idea. And then I'd be like, put who on my pull list, please?
I want to know, like, where does McNulty go after this one again? You know,
right.
This time we are going to once again we're going to wrap it up here, Paul. Because we want you to come back, hopefully, like I said.
Alive, preferably. Yeah.
And we hope you had a good enough time, and there's a lot left that we can get to with you. And again, I know you're not feeling your best. We really appreciate it. You're a damn trooper is what you are.
Oh, thanks, man. I really appreciate that. I would like to plug Turtles in Time really briefly
again. I'm going
to
give you a chance. Brett's going to give his goodbye, and then your chance
I will
to
shut
plug.
up.
Then it'll be...
No, I'm going to plug it right now. Right now.
We have a segment we like to call Plug Your Shit. And
so Paul Aller, plug your shit. There you go. Okay.
There you go.
Okay, now you can go. Yeah, you're good to plug it.
Oh, are we good now? Yeah. I'm sorry. I thought you had some stuff.
Yeah, I didn't want to say goodbye.
No. I will say goodbye after.
Oh, nice.
I don't really have anything to plug. Okay, cool. Let me start off with the thing that's a little further out. Past the Last Mountain, we don't have a release date for it, but it's going to be awesome. So watch for that. Because I think that a lot of people will really enjoy that one. But yeah, this week, Turtles in Time, number one, comes out. It is the turtles in prehistoric times fighting dinosaurs. The first page of the story is a splash page of Raphael punching a velociraptor right in the jaw. And then it only gets better from there. Ross Campbell does the art and Bill Crabtree does the colors, and it is just one of the best looking books you'll ever see. I love the fact that it's coming out right as we get into summer, because I feel like this book, more than anything else I've ever worked on, is really like the comics equivalent of like a really nice pop song, like a really nice pop single, as a cool way to have some fun and kick off the summer. So yes, Turtles in Time, number one. Buy it, love it, shave your head and hand it out at the airport. And for folks who live around Indiana, Ultra Ego Comics in Muncie, I will be there signing copies of Turtles in Time number one on Wednesday from 3 to 7, unless this comes out after Wednesday, in which case, sorry.
We'll try and get it up before then. And on Twitter, you are?
At Twitter, I am Paul Aller. It's Allor. Like all or nothing. Leave off the nothing.
See, it's nothing. It's absolutely nothing. Exactly.
Right? Uh-huh. Yes.
All right. Well, Paul Aller, thank you so much for coming on the show. And I would certainly ask everybody to go out and buy all of your work anyways. We did, Ooh. And we like it. And so, yeah.
Except for that one. Yeah, with that panel that wasn't good.
Yeah.
You just overwrote that one panel.
Yeah, there was that panel. Oh, man.
Yeah, that panel.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
But again, thank you so much for coming on the show. We've had a great time. Hope you've had a great time. And so we will talk to you soon. And for us, thanks a lot.
Excellent. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Hey, can I plug a little bit more of my
of
shit?
Of course you can.
Go back and
yeah,
edit,
that's what
edit,
we
edit,
do.
Edit it in or just leave it here. Okay, because I forgot. July, I actually have two trades coming out. I'm not used to having trade paperbacks of my stuff come out. It's never really happened before, so I keep on forgetting about it. But yeah, in July, the trade paperback for Outram Empire comes out. It's a three-issue mini about Krang and his rise to power and fall from. And also in July... G.I. Joe Siren Song, which collects my 4-issue run on the main G.I. Joe book, is out as well.
Totally.
We didn't even talk to you about that. We
totally forgot about the G.I. Joe.
We really enjoyed that too.
I have so much awesome stuff going on, you know, it's tough to fit it all in.
It is. And you know what? That Siren Song definitely, that was a new character. I thought that was an interesting take I love how the first couple issues were her, and then you shifted focus a little bit, you know. Yeah, just a really cool concept. Like, so much potential, again, that character. And you introduce a new character into an already established world. So much potential. Brett, say something about that, and then we'll go, because
yeah.
We'll talk more about that next time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm a huge G.I. Joe fan. Like, I love the Real American Hero, Larry Hama
yeah.
run.
And,
you know, so as I'm, like, it's interesting, because we interviewed Fred Van Lente, who wrote, of course, the first 11 issues, and then to have you on afterwards, and it was kind of like, yeah, we're going to do the whole G.I. Joe like,
but it's just like, on.
Oh, yeah, completely forget. Yeah, perfect. But yeah, see, there we go. Now we have a perfectly good reason to have you on again.
Yeah.
Excellent. That sounds awesome.
All right, thank you, sir.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, later this year we'll talk some more. Like when Past the Last Mountain comes out, that might be a good opportunity to come on again.
Perfect. Absolutely.
Sounds good, sir. We look forward to having you a semi regular, at least twice a week.
Twice a week. Sounds good. All right, so I'll talk to you guys on Tuesday.
Woohoo!
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
All right, bye.